So the origins of Trotskyism and the fight against Stalin. Well, I just wanted to start off with what might seem a bit of an obvious statement, but I think it's worth actually going over, that this is not just the story of a conflict between two men. Events within Russia and in the international revolutionary movement were the catalyst in each successive round of conflict. This was not just some petty personality clash, but a struggle for the future of socialism in Russia and internationally. Trotsky, who had been the organiser of the October Revolution, and the Red Army, who had been a revolutionary for decades before the revolution, imprisoned and exiled by the Tsarist police, wrote in 1935, "I think that the work in which I am now engaged, despite its extremely insufficient and fragmentary nature, is the most important work of my life." At that time, Trotsky had seen almost all of his family killed by agents of the party who once led with Lenin. Nearly all of the leaders of the revolution were gone, dead, exiled, imprisoned or murdered by a sadistic regime headed by one of their own. This was just 2 years after the German working class, the best organised and most advanced working class in the world, had allowed Hitler to come to power without a whimper. When the genuine revolutionary tradition had been hounded out of the international working class movement by stooges, spies and party functionaries distinguished only by the suppleness of their spines and the shortness of their memory. Against it all stood Trotsky. The fight that he led against the degeneration of the Russian Revolution and in the international revolutionary movement from 1923 on allowed the vision of revolutionary Marxism to survive the nightmare of the Stalinist dictatorship. This fight was so tough and the defeats in the working class were so bitter that Trotsky had to muster all of his considerable intellectual force and courage to wage it. So he left us not only with the genuine Marxist tradition, but a richer one at that. The story of his fight is not just about the ins and outs of the various factions within the Bolsheviks, but a wealth of other questions, you know, things like the appropriate attitude to the trade union and labourite leaders, permanent revolution, internationalism, the united front, the nature of fascism, and the beginnings of a materialist understanding of the nature of the Stalinist regime. So, the Bolsheviks had always maintained that if the revolution that began in Russia did not spread internationally, the revolution was doomed to capitalist restoration. This was the framework through which they saw all of their tasks, both before, during and after 1917. And the Communist International, the Comintern, was established in 1919 for this very reason. But the problems within Russia itself weighed heavily on the fledgling worker state. The Civil War devastated a country that had already been ravaged by the First World War and then the disruption of the revolution itself, so that by the end of the Civil War, Russia's national income amounted to one-third of the income of 1913. It produced one-fifth of all goods. In the same period, Moscow's population had dropped by one-half and Petrograd's by two-thirds. The old industrial working class, the leaders of the October Revolution, on whom the new state was founded and the authority of the Bolshevik Party rested, had all but disappeared. The measures introduced by the party to deal with the civil war and the peasants' demands contributed to the growth of a state bureaucracy, the stifling of democracy in the party and the merging of the bureaucracy with the state apparatus, or with the party apparatus, sorry. In his last year, Lenin warned of the dangers of the bureaucracy time and again, more because the dangers of the civil war, the internal democracy that had characterised the Bolshevik party during the revolution had essentially, but not totally, been abandoned. At the 10th Party Congress in 1921, formal factions were banned, albeit temporarily according to the resolution, although permanently in practice. Increasingly, and particularly as Lenin withdrew from political life because of his illness, the demand for party cohesion was useful to stifle debate. And it was this process, began in the hardships of the Civil War and consolidated in the period after it, that caused the degeneration of the party. This process was not an inevitable outcome of Bolshevik ideology, but it did determine the parameters for Trotsky's struggle against Stalin. So right from the end of the Civil War until the rise of the Troika, that's a Russian word for triumvirate, basically, of Zinoviev, Kamenev and Stalin during Lenin's illness, Trotsky and Stalin had been in constant disagreement. But none of these debates were silent, although they were mostly carried on within the confines of the top party leadership. But nor did they as yet represent much more than a clash of opinions. But the conflict was increasing with the magnitude of the problems that Russia faced. Trotsky's main argument at the time was that there needed to be more planning in the industrial economy. He saw the issue as a central one. He argued that the Bolsheviks had to build up the nationalised sectors of the economy in order to work towards the building of socialism in Russia in preparation for the international revolution. In these years also, Trotsky vigorously defended the ban on factions. He attacked those opposition groups, such as the Workers' Opposition, who called for the restoration of democracy in the party and the state, because he said that they underestimated the dangers that Russia faced. Until he was exiled from Russia, Trotsky's attitude to party democracy, I think, was somewhat fraught. On the one hand, he defended the ban on factions and the suppression of other political parties. On the other hand, from 1923 onwards, Trotsky railed against the bureaucratic and nepotistic way that the party was run by Stalin and called for freedom of debate in conferences and in the party press. So the left opposition, get on to it, first took shape in late 1923. At the time, there was an economic crisis that was causing mass discontent with strikes in the factories, peasant revolts and the growth of opposition in the party. In October, Trotsky wrote a letter to the Central Committee calling for greater planning in industry and for greater party or democracy within the party. This was followed by a letter signed by 46 leading party members, including members of the earlier formed Workers' Opposition, who agreed with most of Trotsky's views around those two issues. Following the letters, Trotsky wrote the New Course in December 1923, publicising his criticisms of the direction of the party and state. In these articles, Trotsky linked the struggle against the rising bureaucracy with the need to spread the revolution internationally, and he wrote, "The struggle against bureaucratism of the state apparatus is an exceptionally important but prolonged task. In the last analysis, the question will be resolved by two great factors of international importance, the course of the revolution in Europe and the rapidity of our economic development." So thus, even at this early stage, Trotsky was sketching out the key questions that were to define his conflict with Stalinism. That is, how to extend as far as possible the socialist development of Russia and the overwhelming need for an international revolution. But the left opposition was attacked as Stalin and Zinoviev accused Trotsky of undermining unity in the critical period of Lenin's illness. During this time, Lenin died, and unfortunately Trotsky didn't speak up when the Central Committee decided to suppress Lenin's testament, in which he warned about Stalin's abuse of power and called for him to be removed as the party's general secretary. But while the impetus for forming the left opposition came from domestic Russian problems, the international situation imposed itself to revive the conflict again. In 1923, the German Revolution that had been fought in fits and starts since 1918 was finally decided, unfortunately in the negative. The French occupation of the Ruhr, along with the explosion of inflation, brought the revolution to a head. All of the conditions for social revolution existed: an economic crisis of enormous proportions, loss of confidence amongst the ruling class, and a rebellion in the ranks of the proletariat. But there was a problem. The German Communist Party had been plagued by a tendency to swing wildly between ultra-left adventurist adventures to underconfidence in times of real crisis. During the upheaval of 1923, Heinrich Brandler, the leader of the KPD, the German Communist Party, constantly sought the advice of the Russian leaders. And at a Politburo meeting in August, Trotsky argued that a revolutionary situation was fast developing. by September, he was arguing in the party press that a date needed to be set for the insurrection. And Stalin disagreed at first that there was a revolutionary situation. In October, at the behest of the Comintern, the German KPD entered into government with the left social democrats in a couple of provinces. The German government reacted by ordering the dissolution of the workers' militias. Communists all over the country were put on alert, waiting for the signal. But the KPD leaders sought the support of the social democrats, and when they didn't receive it, they called off the planned general strike with the support of the Russian leadership. The revolution was thrown away. 1923 was the closest that any country had come to social revolution since Russia in 1917. Its defeat was to usher in an era of stabilisation for capitalism, of retreat for the working class. It was the single greatest turning point for the fate of the Russian Revolution. And only Trotsky recognised its importance at the time. So since the collapse of the left opposition in late 1923, Trotsky had tried to avoid public controversy with the Troika, although their harassment of him continued. But Trotsky, you know, couldn't remain silent in the face of this catastrophic defeat, caused in large part by the members of the Troika. And his opening came in late 1924 when he was asked by the state publishers to prepare a preface for a book collating his speeches and writings from 1917. And in that essay called Lessons of October, Trotsky used the examples of 1917 in Russia and 1923 in Germany to clarify a number of important questions. First, he compared the role of the two communist parties to show that the critical moment of the insurrection was absolutely important that the Revolutionary Party plays the correct role. So it's not just in revolutionary situations, but in particular the necessity of a revolutionary party to be determined at the apex and to carry through systematically the insurrection, which is an essential part of the transfer of power from the bourgeoisie to the workers. So he wrote, "To seize power is to change the course of history. Is it really true that such a historic event can hinge upon the interval of 24 hours? Yes, it can. When things have reached the point of armed insurrection, events are to be measured not by the long yardstick of politics, but by the short yardstick of war. To lose several weeks, several days, and sometimes even a single day is tantamount under certain conditions to the surrender of the revolution, to capitulation." And that's essentially what happened in Germany. He also further developed on the idea that the present epoch was an intensely volatile one. The failure of the German Revolution would give the European bourgeoisie a chance to establish a stability they had not enjoyed since the First World War, but that stability wouldn't last. Despite this dreadful defeat, the revolutionary opening would come again, but the party needed to be ready for it and determined in the critical moment. So in Lessons of October, Trotsky also defended his own role in the revolution of 1917, which was being attacked by the Troika. So he attacked the role that played by Zinoviev and Kamenev, who were at the time the two leading members of the Troika, for the role that they had played in October 1917. If you remember, they'd opposed the insurrection and actually leaked it to the press. Well, their reaction was vicious, as you can imagine. The so-called literary debate waged in late 1924, and it consisted basically of the Troika mobilising almost all leaders of the party to write attacks on Trotsky's history of 1917. Stalin wrote that it is the duty of the party to bury Trotskyism as an ideological trend. In January 1925, Trotsky was forced to resign as People's Commissar of Army and Fleet Affairs and as Chairman of the Revolutionary Military Council. These are positions that he had held since 1917. And it wouldn't be until Zinoviev and Kamenev broke from Stalin and approached Trotsky in the spring of 1926 that he would again resume the fight. Well, like I said, 1923 was a turning point, because in the dying gasp of the German Revolution whispered the new ideology of the bureaucracy, socialism in one country. Thanks. Pessimism and weariness undercut the ground of the Bolsheviks' revolutionary internationalism. By December 1924, Stalin could openly proclaim that the goal, the end goal of the Russian state was the development of socialism in Russia alone. Trotsky wrote later that the large-scale defeats of the European proletariat and the very first modest economic successes of the Soviet Union suggested to Stalin in the autumn of 1924 the idea that the historic mission of the Soviet bureaucracy was to build socialism in one country. It expressed unmistakably the mood of the bureaucracy. When speaking of the victory of socialism, they meant their own victory. To Trotsky, socialism in one country represented the absolute abandonment of revolutionary principles of the Bolsheviks. His polemics against the theory tear to pieces the idea that one worker state in the midst of worldwide capitalism is able to develop, even at a snail's pace, towards socialism without other revolutions, helping to complete the task. But unfortunately, you know, this is an argument that some socialists still make today. It was at the 6th Congress of the Comintern in 1928 that the program containing the theory was to be adopted as the program of the international communist movement. And in response, Trotsky wrote the essay, "The Program of the International Revolution or a Program of Socialism in One Country," that today is published under the name of the Third International after Lenin. Trotsky's argument was that the necessity of internationalism flows out of the very nature of capitalism, in particular its combined and uneven development. And of this process, he writes, "Imperialism links up incomparably more rapidly and more deeply the individual national and continental units into a single entity, bringing them into the closest and most vital dependence upon each other, rendering their economic methods, social forms and levels of development more identical. At the same time, it attains this goal by such antagonistic methods that the unification and levelling of world economy which it has effected is upset by it even more violently and convulsively than in the preceding epochs." So Lenin in 1917 wrote that the convulsions of the during the convulsions of the World War, capitalism broke at its weakest link, that is Russia. It was precisely the backwardness of Russia, of Russian capitalism, that sort of allowed the regime to fall. But that backwardness was also the reason that the revolution would require the assistance of other worker states in order to develop the productive capacity necessary for a socialist society, you know, one that shared prosperity, not poverty. Now, ignoring this basic tenet of Marxism, the theory of socialism in one country as developed by Stalin and Bukharin claimed that the USSR had already contained within it all that was necessary and sufficient to build socialism in one country. And therefore, the only difficulty was that the capitalist world would interfere through military intervention. To this, Trotsky replies, "The capitalist world shows us by its export and import figures that it has other instruments of persuasion than those of military intervention. To the extent that the productivity of labour and the productivity of a social system as a whole are measured on the market by the correlation of prices, it is not so much military intervention as the intervention of cheaper capitalist commodities that constitutes probably the greatest immediate menace to the Soviet economy. Stalin and Bukharin do not want to understand that a Ford tractor is just as dangerous as a Crusoe gun, with the sole difference that while the gun can function only from time to time, the tractor brings its pressure to bear upon us constantly." So to sort of sum up his arguments against socialism in one country, he said that it exaggerates the productive forces of the USSR, it shuts its eyes to the law of uneven development of the various branches of industry, it ignores the international divisions of labour, and finally and most importantly, it forgets the most important contradiction inherent in the imperialist epoch, the contradiction between the productive forces and the national barriers. He said, "Revolutionary and historical dialectic have been displaced by a skinflint reactionary utopia." So the theory of socialism in one country also had a profound effect on the Comintern. Trotsky writes, "The new doctrine proclaims that socialism can be built on the basis of a national state only if there is no intervention. From this, there can and must follow a collaborationist policy towards the foreign bourgeoisie with the object of averting intervention. In such a volatile political situation, this policy led directly to the defeat of workers' movements and revolutions, in particular in Britain and China." So the first time this became obvious was in the role of the Russian leadership in the Anglo-Soviet Trade Union Committee and the British General Strike in 1926. In April 1925, a joint declaration was issued between the British Trade Union Congress and a Russian trade union delegation for the establishment of the Anglo-Russian Committee to work for international trade union unity. The leadership of the trade union movement in Britain had moved sharply to the left, at least in rhetoric, in response to the workers' disgust at the policies of the first Labour government elected in 1924. Zinoviev was actually so impressed by the left phraseology of the leadership that he came to the conclusion and argued openly that there could be a socialist revolution in Britain led by the trade union leadership without the Communist Party playing an important role. And during this time, the stage was being set for an almighty showdown between the British state and the miners. On the 1st of May 1926, 1 million workers were locked out of the mines. The Trade Union Congress called only certain workers out on strike in response, even though there was a massive sympathy amongst the working class for the miners. Still, from the 4th to the 12th of May, the strike grew in strength. The TUC General Council, the governing body of the Trade Union Congress, orders were holding back sections of workers who wanted to join in the strike. Then on May the 12th, as the strike was still escalating, it was called off. The General Council had been negotiating in secret with the government and the mine owners. The two miners' representatives on the General Council were absent, while the rest of the council voted unanimously to end the strike. The miners had to fight on alone for another 6 months. Encouraged by the Russian leaders' enthusiasm for the left of the Trade Union Congress, the slogan of the Communist Party during the strike was "All power to the General Council." Under guidance from the Russians, they tailed their allies of the General Council. But, see, the left had sold out just as much as the right. The vote on the General Council was unanimous. The Russian leadership's response to the betrayal of the left of the General Council of the British workers was to continue the Anglo-Russian Trade Union Committee. It was only disbanded after about just over a year when the trade union, the TUC members, decided that they no longer had any use for it. From the first, Trotsky argued against placing faith in the left of the leaders by the Comintern. Even in Lessons of October, he had criticised Zinoviev. He said, "Without a party, apart from a party, over the head of a party, or with a substitute for a party, the proletarian revolution cannot conquer." That is the principal lesson of the past decade. It is true that the English trade unions may become a mighty lever of the proletarian revolution. They may, for instance, even take the place of a workers' Soviet under certain conditions and for a certain period of time. They can fill such a role, however, not apart from a communist party, and certainly not against a party, but only on the condition that communist influence becomes the decisive influence in the trade unions. We have paid too dearly for this conclusion with regard to the role and importance of a party in a proletarian revolution to renounce it so lightly or to even minimise its significance. His pamphlet, Where is Britain Going?, exposed the shallowness of the left trade union leaders' leftism, demanded that the communists not place their faith in the reformists and not lose sight of the importance of the Revolutionary Party. And his writings on the trade union and labour leadership, I think, are a brilliant critique of reformism, a clear articulation of the need of a revolutionary party to win workers away from the reformist leadership in times of crisis. Thanks. Now, from the spectacle of the Anglo-Soviet Trade Union Committee to the wretched handling of the communist, the Chinese Revolution, it seemed to me that the Russian leadership was seriously determined to turn Marx on his head. They even decided that history would repeat itself, first as fast, second as tragedy. The Chinese Communist Party was formed in 1920, and it grew rapidly from a few hundred members to tens of thousands at the height of the revolution, becoming the pole of attraction for the radicalising relatively young but powerful Chinese working class. But the party was young and inexperienced, so it was easily dominated by the Comintern representatives sent from Moscow. In 1924, under the direction of the Comintern representative in China, the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, joined the Kuomintang, the bourgeois nationalist organisation then headed by Chiang Kai-shek. Stalin and Bukharin, who by 1925 had replaced Zinoviev as the head of the Comintern because there'd been a split in the Troika, maintained that the Chinese Revolution would be a bourgeois in character because the country was both economically backward and oppressed by imperialism. So the Kuomintang, the bourgeois nationalists, were supposedly the real revolutionary force. The role of the Communist Party was to strengthen the Kuomintang. To back up their muddle, Stalin and Bukharin attempted to apply Lenin's 1905 formulation that the Russian Revolution, because it would not be a socialist revolution, would have to, as its goal the democratic dictatorship of the workers and the peasants. Now, not only was this absurd because the 1905 position was patently wrong given the successful socialist revolution in 1917, but Lenin himself had junked the position anyway. But even judging from the 1905 position, if you want to take that one, the Bolsheviks had never submitted to the discipline of the bourgeoisie nor even sought an alliance with them. So despite misgivings, the Chinese Communist Party submitted and they stayed in the Kuomintang throughout the revolution. The Russian leaders' fawning over bourgeois and liberal allies continued in China as it had in Britain. In 1926, Chiang Kai-shek was made an honorary member of the Executive Committee of the Comintern. A few weeks later, he carried out his first coup in the Kuomintang, arresting communists in positions of power. That year, Chiang launched the Northern Expedition and everywhere peasants and workers were in revolt. In March 1927, the CCP led the workers in Shanghai in armed insurrection, with workers taking control of the entire city in preparation for the arrival of the Kuomintang. On the eve of that arrival, the leadership of the CCP again contacted the Comintern requesting permission to leave the Kuomintang. They were told again to submit to the Kuomintang upon its arrival in Shanghai. It arrived on the 26th and massacred thousands of communists and sympathetic workers. Trotsky's biographer, Isaac Deutscher, writes, "The hidden implications of the doctrine of socialism in one country were brought out and written in blood on the streets of Shanghai. Stalin and Bukharin considered themselves entitled to sacrifice the Chinese Revolution in what they believed to be the interests of the consolidation of the Soviet Union." Now, Deutscher is fairly critical of Trotsky for not picking up on the questions of the Chinese Revolution earlier than he did. And I think there's some truth to that criticism. But it's also the case that Stalin and Bukharin did their best to suppress every bit of news about the betrayals of the Kuomintang and also the fact that the CCP leaders had argued to leave the Kuomintang, and Trotsky was clearly not aware of that. Also, up to the end of 1927, Trotsky had actually been ambiguous about whether or not he agreed with his theory of permanent revolution, and it was only the events in China that Trotsky comes out for the first time to argue for it. So with permanent revolution, he maintained that despite imperialist oppression, the Chinese bourgeoisie would be just as cowardly, just as scared as revolution from below, as the Russian bourgeoisie had been in 1905. Only the working class, leading the peasantry, could overthrow imperialism, and this dynamic would lead to the development of a socialist revolution. Thanks. The call to dampen down the workers' and peasants' demands and the reliance on the Kuomintang would lead to the crushing of the revolution. That wake everyone up. Now, the massacre in Shanghai spurred the opposition into activity. During 1926, Zinoviev and Kamenev had joined with Trotsky to form the United Opposition. Stalin was in a precarious position. Many of the most respected leaders of the party were in the United Opposition, and the disastrous policies of the Anglo-Soviet Committee and the Chinese Revolution haunted him. In preparation for the 15th Party Congress in September 1927, the United Opposition developed a platform. It spoke about the need for industrialisation and the development of the nationalised sectors of the economy, of the Russian economy, the gradual and voluntary collectivisation of agriculture, more taxes on the kulaks and other wealthy sections of society, improvements in the living standards of workers, more democracy in the workplace. The opposition made one last push into the working class, speaking at factories throughout Moscow and Leningrad. Unfortunately, they came up against widespread apathy of the workers, but also a vicious and well-coordinated campaign from Stalin's henchmen. Stalin banned the distribution of the platform. He arrested printers on trumped-up charges and delayed the Congress until he was sure that he could push through the expulsions of Trotsky and Zinoviev. He was sure by November, in a special session of the Central Committee and the Central Control Commission, Trotsky and Zinoviev were expelled from the party for incitement to counter-revolutionary demonstrations. Other oppositionists were expelled from leading bodies as well. And then in early 1929, Trotsky was exiled from Russia. So at this point, the question keeps coming up that could Trotsky have done something more, something better in order to have beaten Stalin? And I think there are some criticisms that you can make of the way that Trotsky fought. And I think one of them, you know, was that he underestimated Stalin's faction, that he focused, you know, first on Zinoviev and Kamenev and then later on Bukharin, because he sort of saw Stalin as this centrist force. The other one was that I mentioned that I think he could have come out more strongly for democracy within the party and within the state as well. Also, you know, because throughout the struggle waged from 1923 to 1929, Trotsky was restrained by his adherence to the ban on factions. Just when the opposition seemed to be gaining strength in late 1923, again in late 1924, and then finally after the formation of the United Opposition, the call by the Stalinists to maintain party unity, accepted by Trotsky, was used then to discipline him, to silence him for a time, and to disperse the opposition. So Trotsky always seemed to be hesitant to build and consolidate and really consolidate the ranks of the left opposition. Now, I think part of the reason for this was the limitation of his analysis of what Stalin and the bureaucracy represented. See, Trotsky's views obviously changed over time and they developed. At first he described the Stalinist factions as a centrist one, as I said, vacillating between the left opposition and the right. Stalin's appropriation of the plan for industrialisation that Trotsky had advocated, although of course Stalin put in the, you know, massive element of coercion. He did this in 1927-28. This tended to reinforce Trotsky's view. But as it became clearer that Stalin's faction would become the head of a bureaucratic state, Trotsky characterised it more as a Bonapartist regime, one that balanced between two contending classes, the working class and the bourgeoisie. Deutsche, I think, points to a problem with this characterization. Trotsky is borrowing this term of the Bonapartist regime from Marx, who used it to explain what had happened to the French Revolution with the rise of Napoleon. Thus, Trotsky was using concepts originally describing the bourgeois revolutions to describe the outcome of a socialist revolution. But there are major differences between the two. The most important being that, unlike the working class, the bourgeoisie actually owns the means of production. It can afford, to surrender a measure of political power without losing its place as the ruling class. The working class can only take possessions of the means of production collectively, that is, through their ownership of the state. Thus, a loss of political power for the working class threatens it immediately with the loss of its economic power and, taken together, the loss of its position as a ruling class. The working class cannot control the means of production if it does not control the state, and it did not in Russia. This was the underlying flaw in Trotsky's analysis. Instead, Stalin's faction represented the interests of the growing bureaucracy, and it was this bureaucracy that developed into the new ruling class on the back of the restoration of capitalism. As Tony Cliff wrote, in a society where there is already the principal repository of the means of production and the bourgeoisie has been decisively smashed and expropriated, a state bureaucracy which frees itself from control by the working class, as the Stalinist bureaucracy did in the years 1923 to 28, becomes the de facto owner and controller of those means of production and the employer of the workers. In short, it becomes the new exploiting class. Despite this analysis, Trotsky's analysis of the bureaucracy, his insistence, in particular from 1933 onwards, that the working class could only retake power in Russia by a political revolution, provided the first Marxist and materialist explanation for the degeneration of the Russian Revolution. And there's another point to be made out of this. The common idea that if only Trotsky had been harder against Stalin, had not agreed time and time again to submit to party discipline, that he could have won. But you have to remember that he was fighting the degeneration of the revolution, the rise of a new ruling class, the restoration of capitalism. This wasn't just some faction fight where the outcome can be decided on the basis of, you know, numbers at a conference. Trotsky had always maintained that without the international revolution, there could be no socialism in Russia, and he was right. Any criticism has to begin with that fundamental fact. So, until his murder at the hands of a Stalinist agent in 1940, Trotsky continued to fight to maintain the genuine revolutionary tradition. He and his supporters did so at immense personal and cost, and in a time of immense suffering and defeat for the workers' movement. But Trotsky continued through it all and left a tireless and brilliant legacy of writings on such a wide range of questions. I haven't got time to go into any more of them, especially, you know, like the theory of the United Front and the analysis of fascism. But it's because of this fight that we have, not today, not only the genuine Marxist tradition, but a tradition that is immensely more rich because of his courage and brilliance. I'll leave it there.